Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The history of the United States military is clear. Torture doesn't work. The military knows that.
We do not condone torture. I have never ordered torture. I will never order torture. The values of this country are such that torture is not a part of our soul and our being.
Well, Donald Rumsfeld from 2005, President Bush from 2004. And is this a coincidence? An article comes out today in the new Vanity Fair that says high-level members of the Bush administration could face criminal charges for some of the harsh interrogation techniques that are sometimes considered torture that they have ordered on detainees. Now, everyone knew this article was coming. We will talk to the author, an international lawyer, in a minute. We had pre-booked him for today, knowing that this was the release date of the article. So yesterday, the Pentagon released a 2003 interrogation document that argues, among other things, that the president is exempt from international anti-torture laws if the U.S. is fighting a war. Interesting timing, at very least. The Vanity Fair article is called The Green Light. The author, Philip Sands, is an international law professor at University College in London, a longtime legal critic of the war in Iraq. You may know the name because, working for Human Rights Watch, he was on the team that worked for the prosecution of Augusto Pinochet of Chile, an arrest in another country for his alleged war crimes in Chile. Sands has a related book coming out next month called The Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values. So, Mr. Sands, thank you very much for coming into WNYC today.
It's terrific to be here.
Is your Rumsfeld memo the same one that the Pentagon released yesterday?
It's not. The one that was released yesterday is a memo by a lawyer called John Yoo, who's already rather infamous, and it describes the circumstances in which interrogation, harsh interrogation, can take place. And in fact, we're pretty familiar with the arguments in the memo that was released yesterday because there are reprises of what was being argued in a famous memo of 1st of August 2002. That's the one where he and Jay Bybee said anything that's short of pain associated with organ failure of death is not torture and is therefore okay. And that's the line of thinking they've been spinning.
So what's new in this John Yoo Pentagon memo?
Well, the difference between this John Yoo Pentagon memo is that it goes not to the Department of Justice, but to the Department of Defense and to Mr. Haynes rather than Mr. Gonzalez.
Mr. Haynes, we know Alberto Gonzalez was the Attorney General, before that the President's Counsel. Who's Mr. Haynes?
Mr. Haynes is Mr. Rumsfeld's lawyer, and he's very close to Mr. Gonzalez and very close to Mr. Cheney's lawyer, who's called Mr. Addington, and they form the inner circle, if you like, of the torture team. And the bottom line of the story is that the narrative the administration has always spun is that the decisions that were taken at Guantanamo came from the bottom up. It was a few bad eggs, it was an aggressive major general, it was a lawyer down at Guantanamo, and somehow this trickled up, eventually reached Mr. Rumsfeld's desk, and he just did the decent thing and signed. The true story is that it came from the top.
Well, now wait a minute. Let me pick apart a couple of different instances here. Abu Ghraib is where they said there were a few bad apples who were doing things that I think even John Yoo and Don Rumsfeld wouldn't approve of, the sexual humiliation and some of the stuff that came out in the photographs. Don't they deny that any torture took place, that there was any, you know, wayward interrogation at Guantanamo Bay?
Excellent question, if I may say. A couple of points. First, the photographs at Abu Ghraib, which took place a year later, October 2003, a year after the abuses at Guantanamo that I write about, identified the same types of humiliations and techniques that were approved by Donald Rumsfeld for Guantanamo in December 2002. So there is a sort of factual connection, and we can get on in due course to the issue of migration of the approval of the Guantanamo techniques onto Abu Ghraib later on. But the crucial point is, what is the role of the Department of Justice in authorizing techniques of interrogation that amount, in the views of some, to torture? What the Bush administration has said is that the famous memo of John Yoo and Jay Bybee of August 2002 had nothing to do with decisions taken at Guantanamo. what I've now been able to establish by interviewing for the first time people like Diane Beaver and Mike Dunleavy, who've never spoken to anyone before, is that that is untrue, speaking also even to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that the decision taken by Donald Rumsfeld in December 2002 off the back of a memorandum written by his lawyer, Jim Haynes, was backed not only by a local lawyer at Guantanamo, but by the writings of John Yoo and Jay Bybee. And that transforms the picture.
And you say for this, they could be arrested if they set foot in certain countries?
Well, the United States has a fantastic commitment to international law and international human rights law. And it's been second to none in putting in place international laws to prohibit torture and other forms of abuse. The Geneva Conventions, the Convention prohibiting torture, are international laws that the US has led the world in joining. So the US is party to those. And the question that arises is, if the United States is party to them and violates them, what are the responsibilities? And international law has created the idea of individual criminal responsibility. A person who tortures is liable and must be investigated, and if shown to be culpable, prosecuted. But that goes further. It's not just the torturers. It includes the lawyers. And in the Vanity Fair article, and then much more detail in the book, I explain how lawyers who give advice or authorize techniques amounting to torture can themselves be investigated and, if necessary, prosecuted for criminal acts.
Philip Sands, author of The Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values, my guest on WNYC. And we can take your phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Is there precedent for such arrests? Is Pinochet himself a precedent?
Well, one precedent, obviously, that everyone talks about is the arrest of Senator Pinochet, which came very unexpectedly, exactly 10 years ago, actually, in the autumn of 1998, when he was getting medical treatment in the UK. And it concerned actions that he'd been involved in, allegations of torture, abuse, disappearance, of more than 15, 20 years earlier. So these things take a long time. But the other analogy, and the one that gets people very exercised, particularly in this country, although less so in Britain, where I'm from, is the analogy of the responsibility of lawyers. And there is, in fact, only one analogy. There's only one precedent, and it's a rather remarkable case dating back to 1947, which is called United States versus Joseph Altstetter. And it was prosecuted by Robert Jackson, famous American lawyer, and Charles La Follette. And it concerned the liability of German lawyers for authorizing abuses. And it was a U.S. military tribunal that established the principle for the first time that lawyers themselves can be criminally liable. And there is therefore a certain irony that it is the very same U.S. Department of Defense that established that principle in the 1940s that now finds itself subject to its consequences.
Now, your Vanity Fair article doesn't claim that the president himself could be subject to arrest, but the Pentagon memo, released by the White House yesterday, or by the Pentagon, takes pains to defend the legality of his actions specifically. They have that that argument that in a time of war, the president personally is exempt from the anti-torture treaties that the United States signed. First of all, I presume that you disagree with that argument, but let's say that those torture treaties were considered to be valid and in force. Would President Bush himself be subject to arrest in some other countries?
Well, the argument that the president is not subject to those laws really is hopeless, completely hopeless and unarguable. And if one were to reverse the situation and find a case in which Americans had been tortured, imagine the reaction if the other state says, well, actually, this was authored by our president or our prime minister, and therefore he's immune from the law and can't be responsible for what has happened. It's a completely hopeless argument. It should never have got off the ground. I focused in this article, in the book, on the lawyers, but of course it extends to the president and the vice president and the secretary of defense. It just, I didn't have them, if you like, in my sights. The heart of all of this, though, is a decision signed personally by the president in February 2002. It's a famous decision when he basically said no one at Guantanamo has any rights under the Geneva Conventions. And the consequence of that, of course, was that the rule book was torn up. The military was left with blank pages. They had to find ways to fill them in. Fast forward 4 years, and the U.S. Supreme Court in June 2006, a case called Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, says that was wrong. And Geneva Conventions do apply, and the common Article 3 standard minimum treatment for everyone applies. And Justice Kennedy then slips in a separate opinion, and this opens war crimes. So you don't need some Brit coming over from London saying these are war crimes consequences.
What did he write? This opens war crimes?
It opens the door to war crimes investigations. This is Senator Justice Anthony Kennedy. And what happens then? By then, in July 2006, what does the administration do? It passes the Military Commissions Act 3 months later, in November 2006. And what does the Military Commissions Act do, drafted by these same lawyers? It immunizes them from investigation or prosecution. So they've effectively created an immunity for themselves in the domestic context.
And it also exempts the CIA from the standards that apply to the military, correct?
Exactly. And the decision that was taken in 2006 was to say, okay, the military can't use these techniques, but the CIA can continue to use them. And of course, that brings us right up to date, because just 2 weeks ago, President Bush, in one of his nice cozy fireside chats, told the country why we needed these harsh interrogation techniques and why he was going to veto a bill that would have made them illegal for the CIA also.
Before we take a few phone calls, I want to ask you about the techniques themselves, because as we heard in the clips at the top of the segment, President Bush and former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld have always maintained that these techniques are not torture. They are certain harsh interrogation techniques that they say are required under certain circumstances, like for top al-Qaeda leaders who may have information about other planned terrorist attacks. And your article refers to a number of different controversial interrogation techniques. You have a number. Was it 18? Yes.
The Rumsfeld memo basically presented 18 techniques of interrogation in three categories. So the lowest was yelling at someone for extended periods of time, which, of course, probably we all do, and no one would think of that as torture. And the worst...
Every parent would have to go to jail for that.
Yeah, every parent would have to go to jail if that standard was torturous. Right up to the upper echelon, which is, of course, the famous waterboarding, with a whole lot of things in between. What is torture in international law? Well, it's defined by a convention that the United States helped negotiate and joined, and it's basically defined as severe mental pain or suffering. What's severe mental pain or suffering? You and I might agree, we might disagree. What I did was I went off and spent time with some clinical psychologists and clinical psychiatrists. I gave them the interrogation log of the man who was interrogated at Guantanamo that I write about, a guy called Mohammed al-Qahtani, and they spent a week with it. They went over it, they marked it up, and they came back and they basically said, look, if you put 12 clinical psychiatrists in a room and ask them to say, was this guy tortured, they would say yes. So I take that as my premise. Why? Because on the basis of the indicators of distress that he suffered, he went through severe mental pain and suffering.
So what are some of the other techniques in this most severe category? Because the only one we ever hear about is waterboarding. So everybody knows now how that's a kind of simulated drowning or the beginning of drowning, the person thinks he's drowning. Can you tell us what some of the other most controversial techniques are?
Sure. Well, let me give you one example. When I first read it, I just thought, well, what's the problem with that? And it was touching, poking and touching. You read that and you think, what's the problem with that? Well, until you imagine that it is someone who comes from a religion who's being touched, for whom female contact is extremely problematic. And of course, as we now know, what was happening was that scantily clad women, in some cases wearing very little, were being brought into cells and were touching, straddling, humiliating individuals, including the individual that I write about. So that's one example. Another example, the use of heat and cold. Now, again, you and I may think, well, what's the problem with that? Well, imagine you're in Guantanamo and you then turn the temperature very high, you switch the air conditioning off, and you then put the air conditioning on at full throttle so that the person is essentially freezing. And you do that for 3 or 4 days straight. Al-Qahtani ended up being hospitalized for 2 days, suffering from hypothermia because of the treatment he had been subjected to. Now, in isolation for an hour or two, it's probably not going to be an issue. But imagine that being done for a period of 54 days in which interrogations are running for periods of 20 hours without stop, and there are just 3 or 4 hours of rest, which is broken through the use of something called white noise. It all begins to add up. And so when President Bush says he didn't authorize torture, I'm afraid, very respectfully, I've got to disagree with him, because he signed off on a system of rules which allowed torture to happen on his watch.
International human rights lawyer Philip Sands is my guest on WNYC, professor at the University College in London, a longtime legal critic of the war in Iraq. He has a new book called The Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values. That's coming out next month. There's an excerpt from it, an article adapted from it in the Vanity Fair that comes out today. And David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if the Supreme Court did make that ruling in 2006, keeping up for the Geneva Conventions and opening the door for war crimes, how is it possible for the administration to pass a law thereafter to immunize themselves? How does that work?
It's a pretty good question. I mean, you might want to ask members of Congress how it was that they felt able to adopt an immunity. I've got to say that both Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator Barack Obama voted against that legislation. But interestingly, the senator who has been very forthright in opposing abuse and torture, Senator McCain, voted in favor of that legislation and has been severely criticized. I'm actually just in the process of writing to each of the three candidates to ask them what their view is on the immunity issue, and I'll be happy to report back when I get an answer. But you may well ask that question, and the administration is now protected by congressional act, although that act itself now is subject to another challenge before the Supreme Court.
Do you happen to know where John McCain is on that law? Because he was instrumental in raising this issue of torture or harsh interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, and saying that he was against them in all circumstances. And that, you know, seemed to put him in a very different category from the president. But then I believe he ultimately supported this Military Commissions Act, and that raised some questions.
He supported the Military Commissions Act, and he also voted against the legislation that would have vetoed the use by the CIA of these harsh interrogation techniques. And I suspect it's to do with presidential politics, and if he wasn't a candidate from the Republican Party who was looking to persuade neocons and others of his credentials, he may have voted differently. But I think one thing that is really important to say is that on these issues of abuse, it's not a left-right issue. I describe in the Vanity Fair piece and in the book one guy, Alberto Mora, who is, you know, strongly Republican, and yet who, when this stuff was going on, he was the general counsel of the Navy, pulled the plug on it. It is he, a Republican, who said, this is un-American, this is intolerable, this can't happen. And so it politically becomes a lot more complex and nuanced when you see who's on which side.
Peter in Rockville Center, you're on WNYC with Philip Sands. Hello.
Good morning. My question is basically very simple. The Congress of the United States, I assume, passed a resolution to agree with the Geneva Convention, and therefore they are parties to violations of it. So it's not only the president, but also the Congress of the United States, because if they knowingly know these acts of terror, violations of human rights via the Geneva Convention are occurring, they're all equally responsible. Would you agree with me on that one?
Well, I think they're certainly, I would say, politically responsible in the sense that by adopting an immunity in relation to these types of investigations, that they have, if you like, colluded in allowing a system to come into being which doesn't give full effect to important international laws, which the U.S. military said is vital for protecting U.S. well-being. But there's another point to make here, and that's this. By creating an immunity, they may have allowed these people to travel freely within the United States, but they've created the very conditions in which investigation and possibly prosecution may take place when they set foot outside the United States. I describe in the Vanity Fair article, and then have a lengthy chapter in the book, my conversations with judges and prosecutors in Europe who were astonished, didn't know about the immunity that had been created by the Military Commissions Act. And one of them just said to me, and I quoted it, it is a very stupid thing to have done because it creates the conditions in which prosecutors outside the United States are bound to investigate because they will form the view that investigation cannot take place within the United States.
So the explosive charge, or it's not quite a charge, it's almost like a prediction in the title of your Vanity Fair article, is that some of at least the high-ranking lawyers in the Bush administration could be subject to arrest in certain countries. Can you say which countries are actually the most likely to go ahead with this if some of these guys set foot?
I mean, I could say that, but I'd be in real difficulty in relation to the people that I spoke with who asked me, for obvious reasons, not to reveal issues of nationality. What I can say is this. Some countries have already engaged in investigations on other matters, Italy and Spain and Germany. Belgium has done it also. The United Kingdom, not in relation to the United States, but elsewhere, has also looked at it. I mean, I come from a country that is a close friend of the United States, shares strong political ties, has the same legal culture. And I have to tell you that in Britain, people are astonished that an immunity of this kind can be granted. And plainly, if some of these individuals set foot in the United Kingdom, they would, where there is an independent prosecution service, face potential consideration. So it's a large number of countries. It's not wacky countries. It's even sensible countries like Britain where this is possible. And I think it's not just pie in the sky. And I think going more broadly, I think what's very curious for me, I happened to be in New York on 9/11. You know, I'm married to a New Yorker and very closely connected with the United States, is that something has happened in the last 4 or 5 years to allow decisions that have been taken that go against the mainstream of all the values the United States has pushed over the past 50 years, which is that when someone does wrong, the law cuts in. And it's un-American. It's curious that that has been broken in this context.
You mentioned that one of the lawyers who you cite, Rumsfeld's former lawyer, Haynes, is now in a top management position at Chevron in a job that you said would likely to cause him to travel internationally a fair amount. Do you have any idea whether Mr. Haynes considers himself at risk of arrest and prosecution and is avoiding certain countries, or for that matter, if John Yoo or any of the others is, for exactly this reason?
Well, it's an interesting question whether they're avoiding countries, whether there are certain places they wouldn't go to. I think if I were them, I would do what others who face difficulties do, which is to, you know, carry out an assessment of the likelihood that within that country or with extradition agreements that country has, a problem could arise. Mr. Haynes stayed, I think it's fair to say he may have been the longest ever serving general counsel at the Department of Defense. It's not clear whether that's only because he couldn't get a job somewhere else that was suitable to go to. But he has just left just a couple of weeks ago, and he's taken up a new position as the general counsel of Chevron, as I understand. That's a major oil company with interests all over the world. Plainly, he will be traveling all over the world, or will need to be traveling all over the world. And I would have thought his company will want him to take certain measures to ensure he doesn't go unnecessarily to certain places. It's not a. It really isn't a totally theoretical risk. You know, in Britain, our former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, there was a whole series of allegations in the war with Argentina over the Falklands Malvinas conflict. After that happened, she had to take care where she travelled, and it's not hypothetical. It's not theoretical. Law firms, lawyers were involved in giving advice on these kinds of issues.
The presidential race is underway. We have McCain, who's been outspoken against torture. We have two Democrats. Do you think that policies will be different depending on who's elected president? Or do you think that policies have already changed so much under the Supreme Court ruling on this and under political pressure that it doesn't matter much?
I think it matters greatly. President Bush, 2 weeks ago, vetoed legislation preventing the CIA from using the very same techniques of interrogation that Donald Rumsfeld authorized in December 2002. It remains a very live issue. It is undermining America's moral authority outside the world. It's causing a terrible political price to be paid. It's very difficult to see what level of security advantage. So it's a real issue. I've just drafted, actually, three questions to each of the presidential candidates. Will they shut down Guantanamo? Will they commit to abolishing the types of techniques that were authorized in December 2002, and will they get rid of the immunity? And I'm just in the process of sending that out. I've had one exchange with one of the advisors to Senator Clinton, and I have to say there was some wiggle room in the answers that I was getting. There was some ambiguity, and I think politicians are obviously adept at not hemming themselves in too tightly. But I think the electorate needs to look very closely at that, because America's standing in the world is under challenge, and America has been a force for good on international laws and on international human rights standards, and I think many of us want to see America return to its rightful place, and that means getting rid of what's happened.
So let me throw this one at you, just over the AP wire, not precisely related to what we've been talking about, but Barack Obama says he hasn't made up his mind about whether the U.S. should be a full participant in the Summer Olympics in China. On the morning show on CBS television, he admitted being, quote, of two minds on the question. He calls China's human rights record and its support for the Sudanese government, quote, a real problem. But he says he's not ready to make the Olympics a site of political protest since it's aimed at, quote, bringing the world together. Is this an issue you're concerned with as a human rights lawyer?
It is an issue, and we've just seen what has happened in Tibet. We don't know how many people died, but a significant number of people died, apparently at the instance of force being used by the government of the People's Republic of China, and that is a serious problem. I can quite see, and I have internally myself, a debate, what is the right thing to do. I'm right now drafting the introduction to a Chinese language version of my last book, which was on the Iraq issue and on Guantanamo and other related issues. And I'm asking myself the questions, how far do I go in saying China's got to step up to the plate? If China's going to be a serious international player, it's got to do what the US and other countries have done, take its international responsibilities. At the end of the day, I think I would err on the side of not attending the opening ceremony, which is the good halfway house at a high political level. And some governments have already said that. The German government has said it will not attend the opening ceremony. And it's just becoming an issue also in Britain. And I think it's fair enough for Senator Obama, Senator Clinton, and others to say, well, let's see what happens in the next few weeks and keep an open mind on this issue.
We're past time, but this has been really interesting. And I want to get in one more caller for you, Al from Valley Stream, who I think is going to say that you treat some harsh interrogators more harshly than others. Al, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. It's about in context here. I wonder when the last article was, I'm saying this tongue-in-cheek, he did on Venezuela's torture and imprisonment of so many people over the years. Or is he just part of the Bush hate syndrome and everything he does is on the United States and on its torture, so-called?
Al, that is a very fair question, and I think people like me have a responsibility to engage in it. I'm not part of any general sort of Bush hate campaign. Where the president has done things that are positive, I have said so, and I think he deserves credit on certain things. There aren't many such things, but there are some examples. Why doesn't Vanity Fair publish an article about Venezuela or Iran's torture practices? Or why don't I write a book specifically on that subject? I think there's a really simple answer to that question, and that is this. The United States is different. The United States is a global leader. It is a country committed to justice and the rule of law. And when the United States breaks with that tradition, we all pay a bigger price. We may have limited expectations in relation to other countries, but the United States is and always has been different, and that's why it remains of fundamental importance that the United States reconnects to these rules and to this system that it created, because no other country can do what the United States has done. And that's the reason I think it's important to focus on what has happened in the last few years, because it's an aberration from what the United States normally holds itself to as the right standard.
International human rights lawyer Philip Sands. His forthcoming book is The Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values. His new article related in Vanity Fair, out today, is called The Green Light. Thank you very much for joining us.
Terrific to be with you. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, WNYC's Bob Henley asked the question, could John Corzine be the one who stops congestion pricing? Stay tuned.